So 2 Samuel and chapter 1, continuing now in the life of David, and the death of Saul brings a chapter to a close, chapter of David's life, chapter of great hardships and uncertainty, deprivation, price was on David's head, running as a fugitive, men and their families to provide for. And it was a very long, demanding, trying 10 years where David was in exile. And yet through that period, David's faith was being tested, it was being deepened, his faith in God, all the more grounded through all the trials and all the difficulties that he encountered. Out of that period came some of the most beautiful of the Psalms, that we have today, where David opens up his heart with his fears and his concerns, his sense of need, and how he was driven upon God and had to find his all in God. And but this great chapter now is brought to a close with the death of Saul. And there are 3 accounts in Scripture of Saul's death. There's 1 Samuel chapter 31, and verse 1 to 13, that's the end of the previous chapter. And then there's 2 Samuel 1 and verse 1 to 10, now told by the Amalekite. And then there's 1 Chronicles 10 and verse 1 to 14. And one might well have thought that with the death of Saul, there would have been now a time of celebration on the part of David, the part of David's men, that their hardships were now over, that the way to the throne for David now is open. It's not just the death of Saul, but his sons, end of a dynasty. And it would have been a time when God himself has sovereignly intervened, as David longed for and wished for, that he would have no part in Saul's death. And God mercifully, remember, looking the other week, spared David and kept him out of the battle. How could David ever have lived with himself if he'd have been a part of Saul's demise and bringing so much defeat and humiliation upon Israel? But God had mercifully kept David through the Philistine warlords and them insisting that David could not be trusted, he should be sent back to Ziklag. And so God providentially, we sang about him this evening, of the great providence of heaven, and how God providentially and graciously had kept David from this scene, of which he could easily have been a part of, and found himself in a great dilemma. And how God not only kept David from the Philistines, but kept David from himself. And one would have thought now that God, having sovereignly intervened in this way, and now Saul is taken away, that it would have been a time of celebration for David. But far, far from that. And that shows us something of the spiritual caliber of David as Israel's future king. And I want to look first of all this evening at David's grief. And we read of that in verses 11 and verse 12, when the news is broken to him of Saul's death. Therefore, in verse 11, David took hold of his own clothes and he tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and they wept and they fasted until the evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, for the people of the Lord, for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. So this is the first expression of David on hearing the news. He is somebody that is genuinely grief-stricken by what he has heard. Now, there is deep, heartfelt sorrow on what has taken place with Saul and his sons and with the forces of Israel. And all that's befallen the house of Saul, there is genuine heartfelt sorrow in all of this. And it will find expression in the lament, in the tribute that makes up the end of this chapter, where very feelingly and tenderly David recalls Saul and what he was and intimations of what he could have been, and so on. So there's grief here, real heartfelt grief and sorrow in toes clone, in a period of fasting before God. And in terms of grief, we are talking of heart-rending sorrow. In Job 6 and verse 2 and 3, Job writes of his own grief. Oh, that my grief were weighed, and all my calamity laid in the balances. For then it would be more than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash. So he's acknowledging that he has spoken rashly. But what Job is saying, if only you understood something of my grief. And for Job, there was the loss, of course, of children. And there was the loss of wealth and standing, reputation. There was the loss of health. He was a man that was stripped bare, having to cope with loss and so many levels in his life. All at once, calamity upon calamity. And what Job is saying, if these calamities could be weighed, then they would be seen to be unbearable. Who can carry this sort of burden of heart? And we can know grief, of course, with the death of a loved one. And as Christians, we are not immune to that, far from that. We read that we do grieve, but not as those without hope. And much of the Thessalonian letter we've been looking at in the midweek, or some period of time, Paul is dealing with this matter of grief and this matter of loss, this matter of concern, and Paul directs them to Christ and the coming of Christ and the hope of glory. But he does so very tenderly and very much aware of the heartache and the hurt that there is underlying somebody that has lost a loved one. There is a grief that is so painful, and the grief process can be at times so perplexing, and a whole mixture of emotions, and can be and seem so prolonged. And so there is this process of grieving, and we see that here with David. He is heart stricken and full of grief over the death of Saul and the death of his sons, and over the death of so many of Israel's pride and joy. Of course, you can know grief also, not just in the loss of a loved one, but in terms of disappointment, in terms of what somebody has become. You can know great grief in terms of what a person might have been or could be. And in terms of Saul, it would have been that very much with David. A Saul that was so wayward, a Saul that was so stubborn, a Saul so rebellious, a Saul that was bent on this self-destructive course, on this path that he walked that took him further and further away from God. And David would have been grief-stricken, not just in terms of death, but in terms of what this person could have been, in terms of God and the things of God, and now the demise and what has befallen him. And we can know grief over children, can't we? And their spirituality, or lack of spirituality. And we can grieve over them when perhaps they go off into the far-off land and they seem far away from the Lord, and our hearts yearn for them and cry to God concerning them, and we can know great sorrow and great pain of heart. There is grief, of course, over the cause of God, and David is thinking here of the house of Israel. It's a phrase in terms of the cause of God and the cause of God's people that is now almost brought to the brink of ruin. And so we see the compound grief of David here, not just in terms of the death of Saul and terms of Saul and all that he had become, but also in terms of Israel itself, the humiliation, the defeat of God's people. And it's possible to be grief-stricken in terms of the house of God and to be greatly, greatly hurt. There can be setbacks, there can be hurts, there can be disappointments by way of church life. There can be differences that are allowed to become, what, divisive and destructive. And these things can grieve us, and that can happen very much in church life. And Paul writes, doesn't he, in that vein, when he writes to the Corinthian church, in 2 Corinthians 2 verse 4, "For out of much affliction and anguish of heart, I wrote unto you with many tears." So here is Paul being quite honest in terms of the grief that the Corinthian church has caused him. And he is writing about the anguish and the grief of heart that they've almost broken Paul's heart as a person who writes in that vein. And of course we can know grief in terms of the cause of God. And things can happen in church life that we find so disturbing and can be heart-rending. And we go to God with great brokenness of heart over the cause of God. Grief can come in many forms and come in the shape of many, many losses. But of course, grief is something that we have to work through. It is a process. And what does that involve? And to what extent can it become a healing process? Well, of course, it involves acceptance. Doesn't it? And that doesn't come immediately, doesn't come instantly. We know with Job, his immediate reaction, wasn't it, was to fall on his knees and say, "The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And we can see the reasoning there and the spiritual reasoning there with Job. But in terms of what he felt and the heartache and the sense of loss, well, that would be something you'd have to work through till that is not just a confession of faith, but that becomes an acceptance of the heart. And that becomes a place of resignation before God. And that can happen in terms of things in life and things that occur that are heart-rending and are painful. And there has to be that time, if there's to be any healing at all, where there is acceptance before God. That God is sovereign, God is gracious, God is wise, working out his purpose, and that we are in the hands of God, our times are with him, and we just rest. We rest there, isn't it? And there is that sense of acceptance before God. And not just acceptance, it involves also time, doesn't it? There is a time to heal, and with the body it is like that, isn't it? There's a healing process in the body, and that it needs time to heal and to recover, to replenish itself. And it can be like that with hurts, and emotionally and mentally, it can be like that. And sometimes there is time and grace and care and understanding needed. And Richard Baxter, when he was trying to cope with grief and the loss of his wife, very much younger than him, and they married late in life, and she was so devoted to him, and they had quite a remarkable relationship. And when he was imprisoned, talking about the Puritan, he was imprisoned in London, everything he'd ever owned had been confiscated, and she managed to find a bed, and she took him into prison, and she lived in prison with him, and was there with him in prison, and was with him devoted to the end. And when she died, he wrote a book. He put all his thoughts down on paper, poured out all his grief, and he referred to what was his melting grief. He felt he had been dissolved, and he just put it all onto paper. And as he did so, you'll find what comes out with Richard Baxter is that, one, he felt unworthy of her to begin with. And he writes about his inconsistencies and his oddities and eccentricities, and he writes about them and how incredible a wife she was to put up with these sort of things. And he begins there. I didn't deserve her to begin with. And not only did he not deserve her, but then he moves on in his writings to one day he will be with her. We'll be reunited. We'll be together. We're only parted for a time. But the working through of grief. And of course, we can say this, can't we? That there is one, isn't there? Who is touched with the feelings of our infirmities. One that is tender of spirit. One that is full of compassion. One that knew what it was to weep and shed tears. One of whom we read in Isaiah 53 is a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, acquainted, familiar with all the twists and turns of grief and all the conflicting emotions. He's traversed the whole landscape emotionally. He knows it all. There is no sense of loneliness, abandonment, sense of heartache and sorrow and disappointment that he has not known. He knows it all. He's acquainted with grief. And we read, surely he has borne our griefs and he has carried our sorrows. And we sing, don't we, in that lovely hymn, so well known, the words perhaps are too familiar. What a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. What a privilege to carry everything to him in prayer. That there is one, isn't there? And we see here, first of all, quite remarkably, a David. David's grief, grief-stricken. And that is something quite amazing when you think in terms of Saul and the treatment of Saul towards David, that David could be affected genuinely in this way. There was no gloating over Saul's death. But not only David's grief, we see also, secondly, David's response. How does he respond then to this messenger, this Amalekite? The Amalekite is grovelling before David with a tale to tell of how he has dispatched Saul into eternity. And he depicts the scene and the end of Saul, and he is adding a bit of colour here and there, and it appears as though he is not quite telling the truth in terms of putting Saul to death, but he definitely has Saul's bracelet and he has Saul's crown, and he is seeking to gain advantage, curry favour with David, by recounting Saul's humiliating death. And how he had misjudged David. And naturally he might well have thought that David now would be glad to hear this news, and that David would reward him for hearing of Saul's death. But how mistaken this Amalekite is, how gravely mistaken, that David's heart rather is full of sorrow and full of heartache and grief. And David's response, well, life, it is made up of responses, and it's life to a great extent is made up of reactions, how we react to situations, how we respond to people, and so on. And somebody has said that circumstance and life, it cannot do any more to us than what it finds in us. What it finds in us is what is there within us, how we respond inwardly to what is happening outwardly. Well, how does David respond? How does he react here? Well, with David, there is no malice. There's no malice at all in terms of Saul. There is no hint of bitterness. For all Saul's hatred towards David, that was so dark and sinister, malevolent, whatever the intentions on the part of Saul to do David's serious harm, it was not reciprocated by David. And what an example David is for us. How challenging is this? That we read, don't we, it takes two to make a fight. And David, in his part, lived peaceably in terms of his attitude towards Saul. And David was cut to the quick even when he took a piece of Saul's garment. That was enough to greatly affect David. And how can I do this thing to the Lord's anointed? And how merciful it was that David had been taken out of the scene of battle at this time. But this Amalekite here, we have to bear in mind something of the background here. David has him executed. The Amalekites, they came from Amalek, the grandson of Esau. You might recall it was the Amalekites who went out against Israel when they were in the wilderness of Sinai. And how it was Moses' hands who were held up by Aaron and Hur, they were held up. And how then they prevailed over the Amalekites. It was the Amalekites then who joined league with the Moabites to go out against Israel. They were Israel's implacable foes, a nation steeped in great, gross, blatant wickedness. And at the beginning of Saul's reign, he was to annihilate the Amalekites. It was a judgment of God upon the Amalekites, and Saul refused to do this. He wasn't thorough in this. And there's an irony here in that it is an Amalekite at the last who takes Saul's crown and Saul's bracelet. And so David has him executed. But in terms of all that had happened between David and Saul, all that we find in David's heart is forgiveness towards Saul rather than bitterness. And of course David himself knew what it was to be forgiven by God. He knew how valuable, how priceless was forgiveness with God. He knew what it was to mess up big time. He knew what it was to be repentant and broken before God. He knew what it was to have sealed to his heart what was God's free and full pardon. And he rejoiced in that, wrote psalms about that. Blessed is he that is forgiven, and so on. And the wonders of that, of the healing properties of God's forgiving grace. And a God who delights in forgiveness. And so for David, he saw forgiveness as something not just to be known, but also something then in turn that had to be shown. And as he had received forgiveness from God, it was something then that had to be extended towards others. And so then, as God delights in forgiveness, we do not forgive grudgingly or reluctantly, but we forgive freely and joyfully. And it is the spirit with which we can rise above grievances and hurts and foster a forgiving spirit where these things are let go, they are done with, they are put aside. And what is the sad alternative, and the only sad alternative to forgiveness? It is that of bitterness. That is the alternative. When hurts come and difficulties and so on, there is either forgiveness or there is bitterness. Those are the alternatives we are faced with. And what is bitterness? Well, it becomes, as we see with Saul, what an example Saul allowed bitterness to fester in his heart towards David. Jealousy and envy and wrongs and hurts. And these were kept alive and these were nurtured and cultivated. And for Saul, it became something of an emotional prison. And we can build an emotional prison brick by brick. And we can do that with hurt upon hurt and grievance upon grievance until we can find ourselves in a dark, grim world that has been of our own making. Now that is bitterness. That's what is bitterness. And we see that with Saul. But for David, there is forgiveness. And so we see not just David's grief, but then David's response. And then let's look thirdly and lastly at David's lament. And this is something quite remarkable, isn't it? We find many tributes in Scripture, tributes to people when they're alive and after they have been taken from this world. And Paul himself often paid tribute to individual people in the life of the church. And he would do that as before God and giving thanks to God genuinely for what they were, what they had done, certain qualities, achievements. And he would do that. And that is something quite legitimate and acceptable. And what we find here is this tribute that how on earth can David pay tribute to the life of Saul? How can he do that when you think of the way Saul lived and what he had become and how he was known? And what we find here is that David dwells upon what were positive, quite natural qualities that were commendable, certain characteristics that could be justifiably set before the people for which they were to thank God. And he's accentuating here the positive. And David is, like in the song, isn't it, eliminating the negative. And David is doing that. And we see David's healthy view and perspective when it comes to people. Now, it's always difficult as a minister when it comes to funerals, isn't it? There are some funerals and somebody, you know they are saved, Oh, then they've had commendable qualities, and that is evident to the congregation and so on. And you can, in all honesty, open up and set their lives before people. But then there can be other people that are quite difficult. And what do you say? What are you to say at a funeral? And we can take a leaf out of David's book here, that David recognises that there are certain qualities that are commendable. And he does that here. And you will find that he mentions throughout this lament something of Saul's impressive physique, his physical appearance. And he begins there. This man was a magnificent specimen of masculinity, and that comes through the very beginning in the lament. And he was a man of incredible strength, and he had a certain royal bearing. There was something regal about Saul and the way he presented himself, and he looked every inch a king. And he mentions that and lays stress upon that. There were military accomplishments. He had known certain victories and triumphs. The man possessed a personal charm, certain charisma. He had an unsparing generosity of spirit. And when you look through the lament, you will see these features coming through poetically with David. There were qualities about this man. He might have been sinister. He might have had an explosive temperament. He might have been given to outbursts. He might have nursed injuries and so on. There were these things about him. But this is not the time, says David, to dwell upon these things. Let's focus on the positive. And of course we read in 1 Corinthians 13 that love rejoices not in iniquity, but it rejoices in the truth. Love doesn't keep a record of wrongs and so on. And what a challenge that is to us, isn't it? What a challenge that is to just dwell upon what is commendable and what is good. And in Philippians 4 verse 8, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, if there is any praise, oh, think on these things. And that's a lovely way, isn't it, to think about people and situations. Don't dwell on the negative, but rather on the positive. And Barnabas in the New Testament church, isn't he, was a man of that character. A man was known as the son of encouragement. And he could see good in unexpected places and so on. And what need there is, isn't there, to be thinking positively, what need there is of that. And he cautions that news is not to be spread abroad of the defeat and the humiliation, that the Philistines will do enough for that. They'll do enough for that. And the need to just keep quiet and be silent and so on. And then he comes to Jonathan at the very last, doesn't he? And he mentions Jonathan and the special relationship that they had together, the sense of togetherness, excelling that of women. Now, of course, modern commentators and so on, more liberal background, they see something of homosexuality here, and of a homosexual relationship here. There's no hint of that. And we're being bombarded with this, aren't we? You look at programs on television, it's as though, well, here's another lesbian couple and here's another homosexual couple. And they're being just, it's like they have to pay homage, they have to do this for credibility. And they're putting the soaps and all the sort of even daytime programs and so on. You will see that here are, it's like it's something normal, acceptable. This is normal behaviour in today's society. And this is the world setting our mindset and our view and our sense of what is right and what is wrong. And they come to a passage like this. You know, what we have here is something of the camaraderie that you might have had in the pits when men worked underground together. And the sense of looking after each other, and the bond that was formed in danger and so on, and an intimacy that was there that had no sexual connotation at all, but there was a sense of being there together. You get it in the army and the forces, and you think of that series that ran, The Band of Brothers, isn't it? Where here they are in danger, and there's a relationship that is formed, and they are bound together. They're fighting each other's corner, but there's no sexual connotations at all in this. And that's what we have here with Jonathan and with David. These were men of war. These were men of battle. And they were men that were joined together in heart, and they had a devotional spirit that was one. And so throughout all of this we find with David, throughout this chapter, we just see something of a man who had a very gracious spirit, a man so disposed to forgive, a man that was capable to rise above hurts and wrongs, a man who just basked in the love of God towards him, and that love flowing in and through him. We sing, don't we? Fill me with gladness from above. Hold me by strength divine. Lord, let the glow of thy great love through my whole being shine. And that's what we have with David. It is the love of God, not just known, not just experienced for himself, but a love that was shown in and through him to others in the midst of hurts and grievances and disappointments and hardships, able to weather all of this. And in Ephesians 5, we read, don't we? Be you therefore followers of God as dear children, and walk in love. Walk in love. That's how we are to conduct ourselves. But we are all the more loving and all the more gracious. And whenever we think in terms of love, we often let the world dictate, don't we, in terms of what love is. And the world talk about falling in love, and they have a very sentimental, very romantic view of love. And it's like something you stumble on, like stepping on one of the kids' toys on the way to the bathroom. That is love. You just stumble on it. But love is not like that. You find that love is something that is active. It is something dynamic. And just as in many aspects of life, you learn to walk by walking. There's no other way to learn to walk. You can get all the books you like, but a child learns to walk by walking. It stumbles, it falls, but then it learns by walking to walk. And the same is true in speaking, isn't it? Where the children, they learn words, and they have to get words they can then put together. It's a process that they learn, but they learn to speak and to talk by talking, by speaking. That's how they learn. And the same is true. You can follow this through in every aspect of life, whether it's swimming. How do you learn to swim? Well, you learn to swim by actually swimming. You put one arm in front of the other, and then you do a width, then you do a length, but it's by swimming you learn to swim. You learn to commit yourself to the water, for the water to hold you, to support you, and the water to take you, and you entrust yourself, but you learn to swim by swimming. And but how do we love? How do we learn to love? Is there a mystery here? No great mystery here. No great mystery at all in terms of love. We learn to love by being loving, by being loving, having loving thoughts, that we think lovely thoughts. That's how we learn to love. Not just by thinking, but by speaking, we say loving things. And then we do what are loving acts, and we apply ourselves to love. That we have a loving approach to people and situations, and we grow and we develop, that we are all the more loving and all the more caring. There's no great mystery here. But that's how we learn to love. And there's a stability, and there's a love that is robust, and a love that can weather problems and difficulties. And you know, we got weddings coming up, haven't we? Now, romantic love will never get a couple through married life. Romantic love will never get a couple through married life. It is that sturdy, robust love that is built up and strengthened and grows and develops as a couple learn what love really is, where you rise above differences, you work through problems, you think altogether differently, you think of another person, and you think in a way that is loving, and you now act in a way that is loving. And that's how we become more loving as a people. No great mystery here. You listen to the world and it's like zap. All of a sudden you're in love. It doesn't work like that in the Word of God. Not at all. It is something that is built and established. And how wonderful that is, isn't it? And that is why, of course, in terms of marriage, you know, the way it's celebrated, isn't it? You know, your silver, your golden, and so on. What is all of this implying? Well, it gets better as you get older, and the love deepens, and a couple are more in love, not less in love, they are more in love, and even more in love as they get older, and so on. And that is the journey we are on as God's people. That as we get older, we are not more intransigent. We are not more withered up like a prune. We're not. That is not how we become as we get older. But no, we become all the more gracious and all the more sweet and all the more able to be reasoned with and all the more tender and caring. And what an example David is for us, isn't he? That in spite of all that he had to encounter, he maintained a sweet, gracious, loving disposition.